The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show, go to KUCI.org.
And good morning and welcome to this August 1st, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you information on how to access us there. You can also follow us on Facebook. You can follow us, Writers on Writing. We are on Twitter at KUCI FM. We're on Instagram, KUCI FM. No reason not to follow us. And as I'm sure you have heard by now, we are celebrating 20 years on the air this year. So if you do the math, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of interviews up there for you to listen to. Today, it's all memoir all the time. And I love this because this morning's guests have written two very different kinds of memoirs. One, a perfect example of a sort of extraordinary moment sliced out of a life. The other, a sweeping family history generational memoir. So a lot of great material forthcoming this morning for memoir writers. I'm here now with Beck Dorystein, and coming up in the second half hour, Allie Rowbottom will be talking about Jell-O Girls. Beck Dorystein was a stenographer in the White House from 2012 to 2017 under U.S. President Barack Obama. She's the author of the nonfiction book From the Corner of the Oval, which recounts her years providing stenography services for the president. Beck was one of three stenographers who traveled with Obama. The book is published by Spiegel & Grau. It's the subject of our chat this morning. Beck, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, Marie.
Oh, thank you for coming on. So I set the stage a little bit, but I'm going to let you do a much better job. I'm going to let you take us into the corner of the oval and kind of how the book came to be.
Okay. So back in 2012, I had moved to Washington, D.C. in September, which is a hard time to get a job as a teacher, which is what I had been planning to do. The school year has just started. The schools are ready to go. I had been a high school English teacher, moved there, quickly found myself working five part-time jobs, teaching, tutoring, also working at Lululemon 20 hours a week and working in a coffee shop. And I realized I really wanted one full-time job, and I started to apply to 10 jobs a day, and then one on Craigslist happened to be for a stenographer at a law firm. And I thought, why not? Maybe I'll go to law school. And so this will be a good way to kind of get a taste of law, legal life. And applied to this job, ended up blowing off the interview because my shift at Lululemon ran late. And this woman from Craigslist responded to my email. I wrote to her and was like, I'm so sorry I missed this interview. I think I'm just overbooked. I have these five jobs. I can't do one more. I'm so sorry. And she responded, and I thought she was just going to be like, you're a horrible person. You're never going to get a job anywhere if you blow off interviews, which would have been fair. And she actually said, this is actually a job at the White House, and you'd be traveling with the president on his international and domestic trips. And I was so blown away, and it was so outside the realm of possibility that I was like, president of what? Like, what are you talking about? And so then fast forward, and I ended up doing the interview, getting the job. And within a month, I was at the White House. Within 3 months, I was on Air Force One. And a White House stenographer is not like a courtroom stenographer where you have a little tiny typewriter and you're typing in real time and you know shorthand. We have none of those credentials, clearly. I got the job on Craigslist. And so our job is much more about discretion. And my job, I think one of the reasons why they hired me was because I had taught at Sidwell Friends, which is where the Obama girls attended. And so I was decent at being discreet. You know, I didn't freak out every time I saw Malia in the hallway. I had already had my FBI background check. And so our job as stenographer was basically just to record the president whenever he was in the same room as the press so that he wasn't misquoted. And after the interview or after the background briefing or after his remarks or his speech, we would go back into our office and type up his remarks into an official White House transcript and release it to the press office and the presidential archives.
I can't believe that he advertised on Craigslist. They advertised on Craigslist. I just love that story. I just think it's so 21st
century.
Well, I am
the last Craigslister, just to be fair. So what happened was my boss started under President Reagan, and it was this, you know, it wasn't a law firm, but it was this regular-seeming office on 16th Street, just a few blocks away from the White House. And normally what they did is they hired people who had sonography background, and they would train them, and eventually maybe you would get promoted and get to work at the State Department. And then if you were really great, then you would get promoted from state and get to work at the White House. And I think the person I replaced kind of left fairly quickly, and so they weren't sure what to do. They didn't have anyone lined up. And then I was this weirdo from Craigslist who actually had a background at Sidwell Friends. So they were like, well, she was an English major. She's been around the Obamas before. She might not be half bad. And they just sort of catapulted me to the top. And then since then, that was a contracting company that had been serving at the White House since Reagan. And then since then, in 2013 or 2014, they actually cut ties with that middleman contracting company. Now sonographers are official White House employees. They're no longer contracted, which means you can no longer get a job at the White House through Craigslist.
And now they don't need stenographers at all, but that's a whole different topic. So at what point did you decide that this was going to be a memoir, that you were going to write about this experience? Was this like once you were in the door, you were like, because I know you've kind of been a writer your whole life. So when did you know, I better start taking really detailed notes about this because this is going to be a book?
I was taking really detailed notes from day one, just because I've always kind of taken detailed notes about anything and everything. And so it definitely wasn't going to change now that I was at the White House and seeing Air Force One for the first time. But I was doing it more because I have, you know, a family that was really excited, and I think they expected me to work at the White House. They thought that chance was even slimmer than I did. It was just not on the radar. It was not on the agenda. And so my mom was just like, what's Air Force One smell like? And, you know, she's really sort of like sensory driven. And so I was writing these detailed emails mostly to her, just so that it's like, I don't want to forget this moment. And so from those emails forward, it was like, I don't want to forget anything. And I think I really started thinking about this would be a book of essays, maybe a year into the job, because as a stenographer, my role was really to type up other people's words, which was fine and good. And I loved getting to be around President Obama, but I always thought of myself as more creative than I wanted to write my own words. So a year in, I was like, wait a second, I think this could be a book of essays, and it could almost be like these emails to my mom where I'm just saying, like, this is what Air Force One is like. Because I would go to parties with my friends and they'd be like, just tell us like the coolest thing you've done recently. And I was like, yeah, I really lucked out. This is a job on Craigslist. Like, any one of my friends could have gotten this job and not me, and I would be asking the same questions. And so I thought it would be a book of essays, and then it wasn't really until 2016 where, instead of it being, you know, I wasn't in the story so much, and it was more just this narrator that was a fly on the wall that didn't have much of a personality of her own. When Donald Trump won, it was sort of this, like, kick in the pants to take myself seriously. It was like, if Trump can win, I can write, and I need to start taking myself seriously. And so I lucked out, and this is where I just sound like an obnoxious, ridiculous person. But one of the many great privileges about traveling with President Obama is that I got to meet David Remnick on one of those trips. And so he's the editor of The New Yorker, and I don't know anyone in publishing. I had no connections whatsoever, but I did have David Remnick's email because he had traveled with the president and he had done an interview with the president. So he was the one person where I was like, well, maybe he'll know what I should do, which I only think I broached him because I just was, you know, I was naive and didn't even understand the pecking order as well as anyone in the industry would have. And so I boldly wrote to him and said, hey, I think I want to write something, like, can you tell me any agents? Like, I don't know how to get a literary agent. He's like, I'm not recommending anyone to you until I've seen your writing. And so he sent me I sent him writing, and he was great and was like, hey, where are you in this story? You're nowhere in here, and you're such a weirdo. You got the job on Craigslist. You need to be in the story. This is what makes it different. And so with that piece of advice, I went back to my apartment and one Sunday afternoon basically wrote the opening chapter of the book. And then it just sort of wrote itself from there.
So awesome. I love that kind of one of the themes of this book is Obama's phrase about dream big dreams or something like that. And really that has kind of become one of the running themes through this, that The other thing that I really enjoy about this is that it's also a writer coming of age, that you had all of these insecurities about your writing and that you were, you know, kind of a closet writer before this. And you know, you're kind of leaking out some of your pages to friends and getting their support. And it's so, I think it's such a universal story for writers who don't feel like they have the authority or the chops to do something. And you almost have to give yourself permission or feel like somebody's given you permission to be a writer.
That's so true. And Marie, I told you before, like, I used to listen to this podcast on my walk to the White House because I felt so alone and so strained all the time that it was like, I'm working at the White House. This is what so many people want. And yet, like, I really want to be a writer. This is what I was writing first thing in the morning before I went to my job every day. And I was writing after work because that's what I love to do. And so as exciting as that is, it's also so painful at times because, as you know, as creative-minded people, you feel really vulnerable, especially when I hadn't been published before this. So every once in a while, I would oh so bravely confide in someone like, I really like to write. And they would always be like, well, where have you been published? And I would say, nowhere. I just like to write. And it was sort of like, oh, well, you don't count because you haven't been published. And now looking back, now that I have had this book come out, it's like, oh, no. I was maybe even more a writer back then because I had to fight so hard for it, and I wasn't getting any recognition for it. I wasn't doing it for anyone but myself. No one was like, hey, good job writing for 4 hours this morning from, you know, 5 to 9 before your full-time job. And so that is so important, is that when you're, like, at your most alone and you're still doing the work, that's when you're truly being the writer.
So true. Yeah, and your observation in the book, a writer writes, and that's what they, you know, if you're writing, you're a writer. And if that's on the back of cocktail napkins or, you know, the back of a barf bag on Air Force One, wherever it is, if you're writing,
yeah,
you're a writer. And, yeah, and what a gift. I love that your mother was so into all of these sensory details, because that's what writers do. And there was another observation in the book about how you, and I don't know if this was your natural instinct or your instinct as a writer, but as everyone was focusing on the president, you were focusing on the details in the background. And you know, while the spotlight was shining someplace, you were kind of looking off into the shadows and taking notes about the behind-the-scenes stuff, which is exactly what novel and memoir writing is about. Was that kind of talk about that a little bit and training your eye on the right things, and, you know, and maybe when everybody else is looking one way, you were kind of looking the other. Was that kind of a natural instinct, or where did that come from?
Yeah, it was a natural instinct. I think also it's totally normal to be, awe-stricken when you're in the room with President Obama for the first time. And I had this lucky, bizarre situation where I actually got pretty used to being in the same room with him, but I was always this fly on the wall. So I wasn't worried about him calling on me because, you know, it was like I kind of had to disappear into the wallpaper. So I just got to watch everyone watching him, which is really fascinating, just as, like, humans interacting with people that we see as superhuman. And I remember sitting in the Roosevelt room, which is the room right across from the Oval Office, and he would often do background, like, roundtable discussions with reporters. And it would be all sort, you know, each reporter had their own story. And they come into this room, and as a high school English teacher, I think it reminded me almost of, like, the first day of school, where you're figuring out, like, okay, well, here are, like, the cool kids, and they've been in this room before, and here's, like, the really nervous freshman who's never been in this room before and isn't sure what to do. And I loved seeing them all interact together because at the end of the day, we're all just a bunch of humans, and it doesn't matter if you have a really cool title at a really cool magazine or if you're just starting out, you're in this room, how are you going to do? How are you going to perform? And I remember one of the first things I noticed was, like, people who folded their hands and people who didn't. And I told my friend who worked in the White House, and he was like, you are so strange. Like, what are you doing here? Do you remember anything about the policy they were discussing? And I was like, not really. I don't. But I remember that David Plouffe kept folding his hands in the corner every time that he, like, right before he had something to say, he would fold his hands first. And I thought that was, like, a really interesting, almost like a final prayer thought before he would interject. And I think that just, it was a, it was so cool to have that vantage point, and I wanted to kind of take advantage of it because I knew it was unique and it was special.
And Obama was such a lover of books, or is he still alive, of books and words, and, you know, such a great writer himself. I'm wondering if, kind of in the course of being around him, did any writerly, readerly advice sort of rub off on you in the course of that?
Yes, so much so. He, and a few things, really. One, he has this insane vocabulary. So on top of just being really smart and having to talk about a number of subjects, you know, on the fly almost, especially during a press conference where it goes from Syria to Obamacare to the upcoming election, and it's just across the board, and you never know. And he's just so patient and so knowledgeable about everything the way we would expect our president to be. He also had this extensive vocabulary. So especially when he did one-on-one interviews with reporters, there was always one word that he would just, like, casually toss out. And I'm like, what is that word? I have no idea what that means. And so it was really fun. It was almost like having my own vocabulary teacher where, like, I would go back to my office, and while transcribing the interview, I would have to look up this word. And then, you know, because I'm a nerd, I'd be like, okay, well, now I have to use it 5 times this week or else I'll forget it. So he was great in that regard. And then also, because he is such an incredible writer, one, he was clearly so busy, and yet even so, he was constantly marking up the speechwriter's drafts, and he would take the time because it was like, I'm going to say it. I want this to be as good as it possibly can. And I love that sort of writerly work ethic of just like, no, like, this is good, and this gets the message across, but I want it to be even better. Mm-hmm. And also, he emphasized storytelling a lot, and I noticed that over and over again in interviews and remarks. He would constantly talk about the power of the story, and you would see that even when he was speaking about the Affordable Care Act. Instead of it being like, you know, we've helped millions of Americans enroll, it's like, no, you talk about one little kid who had reached his lifetime cap, and then because of the Affordable Care Act, his parents didn't have to go into debt. Hmm. And it's like, that's how you reach people, and storytelling is such a big part of that, and I loved that he respected storytelling, you know, as much as anyone else.
He also displayed the full range of emotion and humanity in a way that I don't really remember of another president in our lifetime. That, you know, he's obviously incredibly smart and sharp and up on policy, but he also can, in the face of tragedy, really get down into the emotional pit with you know, distraught parents or distraught military families, or, you know, and that. And I think that also has to, I don't know, it touches on all the spectrums of what you would do as a writer, you know, and it's, makes everything much more human. And what a gift.
Oh, yeah. And I think also, don't they show studies like every year where it's like reading makes you more compassionate?
Yeah.
Because I often thought of that where it's like he reads all the time and he understands this grief and he handles it so graciously and like really just allows people, you know, he absorbs it for these people. And it's, especially with the shootings, I felt like there was a while where it was almost back to back to back where we were going to these services and being like, how are we meeting with more parents who have lost people? How is this still going on? And he just shouldered it. And talk about compassion.
Yeah.
So I think it does key into how much he read and kind of getting outside of himself and realizing all of these lives and how they're intertwined and how we're all pretty connected.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Beck Dory Stein. The book, From the Corner of the Oval, is about her time as a stenographer in the Obama White House. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. So we should also mention that a big part of the memoir is the talk about the personal being political or the political being personal. A big part of this is also sort of your personal, there's a romance heavily woven through this, and your honesty and cut to the bone observations and ability to be so vulnerable on the page is so wonderful throughout all of this.
Thank you.
So first, let's talk about sort of the privilege, if there's any privileged information about, you know, what happens in the White House stays in the White House sort of thing that you had to navigate around. and then we'll kind of get into the weave of the story. But was there anything kind of tap dancing around privileged stuff that you had to worry about in this, or was it all just, you know, all of your observations were kind of fair game?
No, I mean, the beauty of my role as a stenographer is that I was really there. I was present with the press, and so I didn't have access to classified information. The whole time I was there, I was flying on Air Force One for 5 years, and I never saw a piece of classified information, which, you know, at the time made me feel very uncool. But looking back, when I talked to Obama's counsel, and she was great, and she was like, Beck, I'm looking at your file. Like, you don't even have clearance. And I was like, I know. And she's like, I didn't realize how unimportant you are. And I was like, I know, I'm really unimportant. And so it was totally fair game, which made my life much easier because I wasn't having to figure out, okay, is this okay to say or is this classified? It was all fair game.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So then talk a little bit about the balance of romance to regular kind of life in the White House as a writer. You know, kind of weaving out that narrative and braiding the thread of, you know, okay, now we need a little bit more romance. Now we need a little bit more daily stuff, just interacting in the White House and the process of being so vulnerable on the page, which you are and which makes this book so great.
Thank you. I think as soon as I realized it wasn't going to be a book of essays and it was going to be about me, it was sort of just like, oh, this just got so much easier to write, but also so much harder because obviously putting yourself out there, talking about a relationship and making really bad decisions, not once, not twice, but so many times. And, you know, it was very easy to beat myself up. And for those who don't know, I started my job at the White House with a boyfriend, and then I had this other relationship with a colleague at the White House, which was a bad life choice and went on. And I named him Jason in the book, which is also sort of funny because since people have read the book, they're just like, oh, well, we've all had a Jason. And that's been sort of helpful to be like, oh, right, everyone has a Jason in their past. But true. I think a big part of it, once I knew I was going to write about my experience in the White House and realize this is going to be more of like a coming-of-age memoir that happens to take place in the Obama White House, I focused more on, okay, if my little sister went through what I went through, or if one of my former students from when I was still teaching high school English were to apply to a job on Craigslist and land at the White House and find herself in this messy, not relationship where every time she tries to pull herself out of it, she ends up in this great hotel in Vietnam and it's raining, or on a balcony in Paris on day 5 of an international trip and there's this guy who is dangerous but irresistible and is always saying the right things at the right time. And I realized he had to be in there and that relationship had to be in there because even though I got to work at the White House, I also had to navigate life in my 20s. And part of being in your 20s is making huge mistakes and falling for the wrong guy. And I wanted all of that in there. And I think what was also cool about writing the book is that I was focused on him at times when I wished I hadn't been. And then as I slowly get a little older and a little smarter, I start to look up more and I start to notice the rest of the world around me. And I think that's like a fun part of growing up, is you start to figure out what's really important and what really matters.
Yeah. And that kind of touches on another thing that I marveled at, which is that you found the adequate temporal distance to tell this story. I mean, sometimes I feel like memoirs, you kind of have to let them germinate for 20 years. But because you didn't do that, it had this sort of immediacy and we were, you know, kind of growing up with you. And, you know, if you wrote this book 20 years from now, it just probably wouldn't work out because we're still so enamored with the Obama White House. But, yeah, I do think it's difficult for memoirists to write and to have sort of the perspective that you need to make sense of a memoir so close to the time period where all of it happened. And I wondered if that posed any challenges for you.
Yes, I think maybe it wouldn't have worked out in 20 years, but in 20 years I'd be like, okay, now I have the right perspective.
Now you can write a different book in 20 years.
Yeah, this was all very, very raw. I mean, I parted ways with the Obama White House in January 2017 and started writing it 2 months later. Wow. So it hasn't been that long. I was asked recently if I was married, and I was like, did you read the book? I'm still healing. I went through a lot of stuff. So,
this was yesterday.
No, I think,
yeah, that's
yeah, I just, I think, you know, there's always a danger in waiting or not waiting or writing too quickly or not quickly enough. And I think what I'm most proud of is that those details and those, like, those moments that are sort of driven by being in an exact moment at an exact time, I think I was able to capture half decently because I wrote it in that moment. Uh-huh. And if I waited too long, I think that would have sort of grown stale. And so even there's always a risk in writing whenever you write. But I wanted, even if, you know, looking back, I'm like, oh, I focused so much on Jason. But in reality, I focused a lot on Jason. I was totally in love with this guy. I was in my 20s. Like, that's what's going to happen. And I think that's a big part of the lesson that I learned. And I think it's also, even if I, you know, focused too much on the guy, I don't care because I also caught those moments that are, like, pure emotional and so real to me because of the urgency in which I wrote them, which was right after they happened.
And as we're reading it now, I mean, you know, because these things just happened within the last couple of years, we can all picture where we were as well. I mean, we all remember all of these events. And so it's kind of more, you know, it's immediate for the reader as well as immediate for the writer. And, you know, that we were all kind of living through this together and we can live through it with your point of view. I think, I don't know, it just lends a fun perspective. You know, it just feels like we're looking at the world through a different perspective that we didn't have, but we can all remember that time frame. So I think
we're all in it together.
Yeah, right. Oh, it's killing me. We're drawing down on our time, but I would love to hear, having come through writing a full book, writing a full book is hard. I mean, when you're scratching on the back of napkins and, you know, writing emails to your mom is one thing, but putting a book into a narrative, you know, arc is another. And I'd just love for you to leave us with some writing advice coming out the other side of this.
So this was a weird project because I'd never planned on writing a memoir. And so I had so much material to work with, and I had the personal, and then I had the bigger political background. And so when I sat down to write it, it was almost like carving, where it was just like, okay, what can I get rid of? And I think I had to ask myself a lot of questions about what was I trying to get out of the whole process, and what was I trying to teach, and who was my audience? And so once I realized my audience was like people like my younger sister and my friends and people where it was like, okay, if I hadn't lucked out on Craigslist and it had been my best friend who had lucked out on Craigslist, what would I want her to tell me about it? And figuring out who you're writing for and what you're trying to write is really important, because I could have written just about David Plouffe folding his hands. I swear, I really could have. And so it's really important to figure out what are your main goals, as silly as that sounds, but it's just trying to stay on that track. And as much as it's important to stay on the track, also allowing yourself the latitude to totally deviate, because who knows where it'll go. I had not even included the thread about my friend Amelia in the book, I think because it, you know, I basically have this big fight with my friend because I really screwed up and she had just been trying to be a good friend, and I hadn't included it because it made me cry every time I thought about it. And we had made up, and it still just like brought up all of these terrible feelings. And then I realized because it brings up all of these terrible feelings, that's exactly why I have to write about it. And since then, you know, it was so cathartic to do that. And I urge that too. Whenever there's something that it's like, no, this is like too much of a scab, I can't go into it, it's like, no, dig into the scab. It'll be good.
That is the best advice ever. Dig into the scab, people. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Beck Dorystein, this was wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me. This is really fun.
That was Beck Dorystein, the book From the Corner of the Oval. You can check her. Well, she's all over the internet right now. And if you turn on Morning Joe or any of the other news shows, she's talking a lot about the difference between the Obama and Trump White House, which I also find fascinating, but we just didn't have time to cover today. But she is all over the web. You can find her. her out there, which I recommend. That is, we are going to take a very short break. Please stay with me. Allie Rowbottom will join me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. We are on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can visit Barbara's website, Pen on Fire, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series, events, and more. Because I'm a total technological Luddite, I just figured out that if you subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, you get little push notifications whenever we put a show out, which is, you know, once a week, which is handy. So I highly recommend subscribing to us on iTunes, and then you just know when we're up. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I am on now with Allie Rowbottom. Her essays can be found in Vanity Fair, Salon, The Florida Review, No Tokens, On and On. Her essay, Ghosts and Houses, won the 2015 Editor's Award from The Florida Review, which received a notable mention in the Best American Essays of 2016. Her long lyrical work, World of Blue, received a notable mention in the Best American Essays 2015. She's taught fiction and nonfiction at the University of Houston and CalArts, as well as at Boldface, an undergraduate creative writing conference. She has been the recipient of fellowships from Imprint and Tin House, where she was a 2016 scholar. Allie holds a PhD in literature and creative writing from the University of Houston and an MFA from the California Institute of the Arts. But it is her debut memoir we're chatting about this morning. Jello Girls, A Family History, is published by Little Brown. Allie, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on. So I did a long introduction of you, but I barely introduced Jello Girls at all. So I'm going to leave that to you and let you take us into the memoir, and then we'll use that sort of as a jumping off point for our chat. Can you sort of introduce us to the book?
Sure, absolutely. So Jello Girls is part memoir, part social history of Jello through a feminist lens, and sort of part investigation of a 2011-2012 outbreak of conversion disorder in a small town called Leroy, New York, which is where Jello was born and manufactured for much of its life. So my great-great-great uncle, Order Woodward, bought the patent to Jello from its inventor in 1899 and went on to sort of make a family fortune off of that. The book sort of traces that history and the history of Jell-O alongside the history specifically of my grandmother and mother, who were living in Leroy, New York, for much of their lives and felt sort of haunted by not the fortune per se, but the attendant alcoholism, addiction, and general malaise that went along with it. And my mom especially spent a lot of her life trying to figure out what exactly was the root of what her family called the Jell-O curse and why it seemed to be plaguing her especially. And it wasn't until she found feminism and sort of started to do her own revision of her family history that she decided that the curse maybe wasn't necessarily confined to men, as she had been told, but also maybe was more collective than she had been led to believe.
I love that. It's funny because when I introduced the show at the top of the hour, we did two memoirs, and one was this very, from the corner of the oval was this very discreet time period in this woman's life. And this, by contrast, is so sweeping, as you say, generational, multi-thematic. And as I was reading this, I was like, man, how would you wrap your mind as a writer around all of this subject matter where you have multiple generations and you have multiple themes and you have mother-daughter stories and you have feminism and kind of history of feminism? And as you're describing it now, I'm like, yeah, she did all of that in a very, in an incredibly unputdownable, you know, readable, compulsive, you know, 300-page book or 250-page book. It's incredible. So I'd love to kind of hear, I don't know, I mean, and it's too big a question to ask how you did that, but kind of when you originally conceived of the memoir, did it stay to that kind of original conception? Did you set out to write about mother-daughter relationships, feminism, the history of the Jell-O, you know, or did that kind of come through the writing process?
That's a great question. So I had all of those threads in mind, but when I sat down to sort of start
the book, I really didn't have, I'd never written a book before, first of all, so I wasn't quite sure how I was going to approach it structurally. And I learned along the way that in order to get all those threads in a really coherent manner and a way that felt clear and organized to the reader, I had to rely on a structure that was more, for lack of a better word, sort of traditional than what I had been going for. My influences prior to Jello Girls had been more experimental, which is also another word that seems so broad and sweeping, but I had envisioned the memoir to be more like Lydia Yuknovich's Chronology of Waters, mm-hmm. or a book like that. Mm-hmm. And instead, it sort of necessitated a more stringent structure. So that's something that I learned. And honestly, it was so wonderful once I found the structure for this book, which came very late in the writing process because it enabled me to flesh out the feminist thread, the Jello history thread, in a way that just feels now so obvious and so important to the book. But at the time, I had all those threads going, but they were sort of buried and interwoven without a lot of organization.
So when you sat down to write, did you do it kind of chronologically, like here's my family story? Or what did those original drafts sort of look like? And then how did you discover what the book really was trying to tell you it was about?
Yeah, I sat down and I started with my mom's childhood and just wrote forward from there. As the book sort of developed, I ended up adding in more of my grandmother, Midge. But yeah, originally I just sort of started it and wrote chronologically, from my mom's childhood forward, with sort of moments of reflection for me as a narrator. And that actually, a lot of that stayed, but I ended up organizing it differently and then using Jello to sort of break up that chronology.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting. So your mother was a writer, and she and really had wanted to write this book, write a book about this. And I was wondering if you felt the pressure of sort of ghosts at your keyboard with you to not only, I mean, it's a pressure enough to write a memoir on your own, but then I was wondering if you could sort of had this voice in your head of your mom saying you have to get this right, or, you know, this is the project I had always wanted to do, and I was wondering if that put any undue pressure on you as you were writing this.
Probably a little. Although I wrote with the knowledge that my mom would be really proud of me, sort of no matter what I ended up creating. Like, she was always very just sort of excited about and very willing to read what I had written and what I had made out of her life. Prior to Jello Girls, I had written a couple pieces about caretaking during her illness. And I remember she would give me notes and be like, well, this isn't how I remembered it. But she was okay with the fact that my memory was going to be different than hers, or my experience was going to be different than hers, and I would do my own thing with the experiences that she and I had gone through together, and she was just very permissive about that in a really freeing way. I mean, she was a writer, she was an artist, so I think she knew on some level the importance of individual artistic interpretation. That said, like, there are portions of the book where I think she would have had me push further, and I held back trying to protect the people I was writing about or protect myself from their reactions in some places, and I think she might see that as, you know, as not going as bravely forward as I could have, but I will say I'm glad I didn't.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that's what her general reaction would have been.
Was the lens through which she saw this experience similar to your lens? Was she looking at this from a feminist perspective and from a, you know, this is a family, the family curse perspective? Was that all pretty consistent with what she had seen as well? Or did you sort of come to new discoveries through the writing process that she had maybe not had?
No, that was her. That was very much her. I mean, she saw pretty much everything through a feminist lens. And I say in the book, she was at times, pretty startlingly essentialist with her feminism, although at times it was admirable the extent to which she was a bit essentialist. But I wanted to preserve that part. Like, that part to me felt so important to the story and so important to her experience of her entire life, that the intersection between her family history and her experience coming up in the world as a woman, and then her discovery of feminism and her the way in which she then saw everything through a feminist lens. It just all felt so essential, not only to the story, but to her character.
So great. That's so great. I just love the Jell-O is, I mean, it's obviously the reality, and it's such a wonderful metaphor. The cover of the book is just such a wonderful, I mean, as you keep reading the book, it just reveals these wonderful layers of complexity over something that looks so cheery and simple and nostalgic and, kind of iconic. And through it, there are just this depths of pain and complexity. And those two things juxtaposed together could not be more perfect. I mean, Jell-O is such a perfect sort of gift for this book. And I was wondering if you found that as you were researching sort of these unexpected gifts that your family history gave you, or if there were inconvenient truths that you kind of had to write around through the research process, something that didn't sort of fit with the narrative, or, you know, just other kind of surprises that came to you through the course of writing this. Does that make sense?
Sure. I mean, I came to Jell-O's history without knowing much about it myself. I mean, I grew up vaguely knowing about our connections to Jell-O. And I should make clear, like, there's a lot of people out there who are connected to Jell-O, and I'm hearing from a lot of them now. It's kind of phenomenal. But the family being what it was, there were so many offspring of Orator Woodward that there's so many people out there. So it's kind of amazing and cool. But I think for a lot of us, certainly for me, I didn't grow up knowing a lot about Jell-O. It wasn't, you know, part of my bedtime stories. So reading about it later as an adult and doing my research about domestic science and so on, it was interesting to me that I could have gone the route of really trying to sort of demonize the product and make it into this, like, clearly anti-feminist product dedicated to keeping women in the kitchen. But honestly, like, I saw it shift at different points in time. It wasn't as simple as Jell-O was, you know, dedicated to keeping women in the kitchen. It was more Jell-O tried that, it worked. They kept trying, it no longer worked. So then they shifted to accommodate women's shifting roles and were sort of at times angling to be more an ally to independent women. And I thought that was really fascinating. I think it would have been too simple and too easy to write around that complicated relationship between Jell-O and women shifting societal roles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about your research process. I know that your mother gave you a lot of her research in the course of her illness and dying. And I assume that you did a lot of your own research. So kind of tell me about when you knew you'd done enough, organizing it, kind of wrapping your arms around it, and then making it not didactic to the reader, but, you know, kind of just interwoven and interesting. Kind of talk about that research process for you.
Oh, well, I'm glad it's not didactic, because I did,
it is not
I did worry about that at times, or just that the transition between the more personal narrative would feel jarring when I shifted to Jell-O. So I'm glad that people seem to feel it's working. So my mom left me boxes and boxes and boxes of her writing about her life and her experience, which I have read so much of. So I used that and to write her life and to then to enter myself into her life at a certain point in the book and talk about her illness and ultimately her death. That came both from her memoir and just from my lived experience. And I wrote all of that first. And then once I had that sort of linear narrative, I went back and started adding in Jell-O beginning in 1899 when it sold, and then using Jell-O as sort of like a time marker in relationship to where my mom was in her life. And that made the research process with Jell-O and Jell-O's history much easier, because I could look at Jell-O and think, what were the advertisements that were going on at this point in time, and do that research and find those. And then I could look at American feminism and say, like, oh, okay, that's really interesting. These two things match up. And I hadn't necessarily intended to place them side by side like that, but it became so apparent and obvious as I was researching that the two were interwoven and interlocked. And that was a surprise to me, and it was also really exciting. Like, I felt very smart and like I was discovering something at that moment that I don't think I really was, but it was truly an exciting experience to do that research.
So does your office look like giant pieces of butcher paper with these timelines written on it, or how did you organize all of that material in your own head?
I had several timelines on my computer, and I would sort of like plug in different sort of ad campaigns with different timelines and then look at that timeline next to my mother's timeline, next to feminism's timeline. But it happened really naturally as well. Like, I'm trying to think of how to explain it, because I think for many writers it's kind of hard to explain how I like organize stuff on my computer and in my head, but it was almost like the book in my head looked like a ladder, and I had my mom's narrative progressing along this ladder, and then like between each rung I would insert the Jell-O history that fit in that time frame, and then would write about how it was interwoven with feminism.
Oh, I love that image. That's a great that's a great image for writers, I think, to use. Yeah, that's great. And then I was going to ask if you had any, I don't know, kind of like I was saying, kind of inconvenient material that you had to write around, kind of inconvenient discoveries. I always feel like when memoir writers are tied to the truth, sometimes the truth is so inconvenient and sometimes it doesn't fit with the narrative. And I was wondering if there were any of those points where you're like, you know, some sort of either research stumbling block or narrative stumbling block, that something didn't fit that you had to then kind of work around it, or to figure out how, you know, it was either counterintuitive to the narrative opposed to a point you were trying to make, and how, if that happened, you dealt with sort of, you know, annoying truths.
The thing that jumped to my head when you asked that question was, and this was annoying, but maybe not for its inconvenience, but it was annoying that I ended up having to leave it out, because I felt that it actually went quite well with the sort of larger message of the book, which is that my mom, you know, suffered more than the sexual abuses that I chronicle in the book. She suffered a lot more, and it's written about quite detailed in her memoir, and just for time reasons, like a time in terms of like the time frame of the book, I couldn't include it. And I made that decision, and it was really hard, and I think it's something that a lot of memoirists deal with, is that, you know, you're writing the story and you're adhering to the truth, but you're also shackled by the constraints of having to write a narrative that people will understand and read, and it can't go on for 1,000 pages, as my mom's memoir did. But I really wanted to include some other details about her traumas and her life that I couldn't. And I had to ultimately make the decision to just gloss over them. Mm-hmm. And that was really hard. That was what jumps to mind. I didn't find so many inconvenient truths in my research process because I was really dedicated to just presenting my findings without sort of cramming them into a message that I wanted everybody to take from it. I wanted people to say, like, oh, this is messy. Like, it isn't always as tidy as we want it to be, and that tidiness is so intrinsic to Jell-O's messaging, but it's just not the way life is. It's messy.
Right. Oh, I love that. I was wondering if you found that writing, if you learned something you didn't know, if this shifted your perspective, if the writing process itself or the act of writing this book changed your mind about anything.
I can. So the first thing that jumps to mind with that question is it changed my mind about the kind of writing that I was interested in doing moving forward, I guess. I had really always, when I was in my PhD and prior to that, I was really interested in more experimental memoir, specifically by women writers. And I had always envisioned that I would be writing in this sort of more experimental vein. And now with Jell-O Girls and in my next work, I've found that I actually really enjoy writing more straightforward memoir, and I would like to try fiction at some point as well. And that did surprise me because I was really, really dedicated to myself as an experimental writer earlier on in my life, and now I find that I actually feel like I can do more in more traditional forms.
That was
surprising.
Yeah, I love that. Oh, we're drawing down on our time, but In asking for your writing advice, having come through this first memoir, maybe focus on what, I think when we write, when we're beginning writers write a lot in the shorter form and the essay form, which is presents its own challenges. But moving from, it's not just word count that's the difference between writing an essay and writing a full-length memoir, but any advice you learned that you can pass on to either memoirists or writers in general about kind of making that leap, that scary leap from, a 10-page essay to a 250, 300-page book?
It sounds cliche, but I've found it to be true that you kind of have to write everything out. I mean, everybody works differently, but for me, I always tell my students this, but just write everything out. Get it all out. Write as many pages as you can until you feel like you've come to a logical stopping point. And after that, then you start to understand what the book is about. That understanding doesn't come right away. And I think very few people sit down at the computer and say, like, oh, this is what the book is about. Not sort of in terms of plot points, but in terms of the deeper emotional core. So for me, I found that in Jell-O Girls and in the next project I'm working on, it really took me at least one draft to understand what the thing I had written was actually about. And
yes,
to give myself that time and is challenging, but also really necessary.
Great advice. Yeah, I think if a writer sits down and knows what they're writing about before they do it, and that is what it turns out to be, it's typically a very boring book because...
Yes, right. Readers want the sense that they're uncovering something on the page alongside the writer. Nobody wants to be spoken at, and I think if you already know what you're saying, it can read that way.
Exactly. I totally agree. Tell us where we can find you. I know you have a wonderful website and you're online. Let our listeners know how we can sort of stalk you.
Yeah, sure. My website is AllieRobottom.com. You can find me on Instagram at AllieRobottom and Twitter under the same handle. And those are pretty much the ways to get in touch with me or to tweet at me or whatever.
I love it. Congratulations. Such a great read.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. That was Allie Robottom. The book Jell-O Girls, A Family History is out and available now. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned for more awesome programming, some great music coming up on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until then, thanks so much. Have a great week.